This is Murray Stein, Jung's Treatment of Christianity, September 16th, 1985, tape 2 of 2.
And that this dark side of God is being experienced in many ways in culture and by individuals, and it needs to be recognized as a revelation, okay, in such experiences as God smashing his cathedral. The theologically minded person would say, well, that is a perception of God dissatisfied with the narrowness of Christianity's understanding of what God is about. Christianity's God is too narrow. It's too small. The Christian tradition, as all religious traditions do, has put the reality of God in a too small box. And so God is breaking out of the box. God isn't a Christian, as somebody said in a seminar the other day. God's not a Christian. And he wants Christianity to open up the box, to see him more fully, to see it more fully. Maybe it isn't a him at all. To open the doors of perception and to let revelation happen, and let's expand our understanding and awareness, our theological perception of God. And in order and what God is trying to incarnate, according to Jung, his interpretations of the dreams and visions and so on of himself and other modern men and women that he worked with, was that God is trying to incarnate or trying to bring into consciousness the dark side of himself. Of itself, that the darkness of God, the destructive side of God, is becoming more and more incarnated, more and more evident in history. If you look at history of the 20th century, Jung felt, and you see God working in history, as theologians are always talking about, where is God in the historical process and so on, it's fairly easy to see the dark side of God. In the 20th century, it's one of the grimmest historical periods in the history of humankind. More and more, Jung felt, human beings are called upon to recognize the dark side of God and to let God show that face, that side of reality to us. This is to see the dark side of God and to admit it and to let it enter awareness and conscious theological awareness and theological consciousness is exactly a parallel to the individual recognizing his shadow. It happens in analysis and therapy all the time. One of the ongoing parts of the analytic therapeutic process is integration of the shadow, as we say. More and more awareness of one's own limitations and culpability and inadvertent or half-conscious or totally unconscious destructiveness. And every human life, every creative process involves a destructive, decreative, limiting factor as well. And so the awareness of shadow in the lives of individuals is absolutely essential to the individuation process, to becoming fully aware of the self and its historical process. And so Jung would say the same thing has to happen on the theological level. That we need to integrate the shadow of God into our theological doctrine of God. So at the very heart of the doctrine of God, Jung would say, we have to build in, so to speak, an understanding, an awareness of God's dark side and God's shadow. We can't have an all-good God out there with a split-off or denied sense of evil somewhere else, in Satan, who gets locked up forever, or all attributed to human beings who are evil while God is good, or denied, as in the doctrine of privatio boni, that evil is nothing but the absence of good, dark is nothing but the absence of light. All of these ways of dodging the problem of evil, Jung objected to. We've got to put evil right at the doorstep of God and understand that as a even as a physical reality, just like physicists say, there's entropy and negentropy in the physical universe. There's a tendency for things to build up and there's a tendency for things to fall apart. And both of these aspects are a part of reality. So if we want to talk about God as ultimate reality, we also have to see both tendencies at work. And so the dark side has to be right at the heart of the doctrine of God. That's the missing fourth, Jung would say. Or one part of the missing fourth. And the other part is the feminine. Now when Jung says that Christianity is missing the feminine, it's a very complicated subject. It doesn't only mean, it also means that there is no female in the Trinity. At one point, he calls the Trinity a men's club. So he says, if you think about a natural threesome, you would think about a family unit. You'd think about a mother and a father and a child. But when Christianity has imagined the threesome at the bottom of reality, there is a mother and a father, a father and a son, and the love that passes between them. Okay, that's St. Augustine's understanding of the Trinity. There's the Father and the Son and their bondedness, and that's the Trinity. And so it's really a love affair between a father and a son. And in the idea that the priesthood is limited to the masculine, is limited to males, you see, this is represented on earth. That because Christ was male and the Father is male, and it's a love affair between a father and a son, therefore the priests, who are God's representatives on earth, also must be male. We have a bishop in, or rather a cardinal in Chicago, Cardinal Bernardine, who is, they say, a strong candidate to be the first American pope after the Polish pope. Maybe we'll have an American. And he's a very wily politician. And he was on television, and a reporter asked him, what about the ordination of women? What do you think about that? And Cardinal Bernardine, very wary about this subject because it's so controversial, referred it to the theologians. And he said, well, the church has asked its theologians to make a careful study of this matter and has asked them to decide whether the ordination of women is a theological issue or simply a historical sociological issue. If it's simply historical and sociological, a product, byproduct, so to speak, of the patriarchy, just a sociological fact, then naturally we can change it. There's no problem with that. But if it's a theological question, then it would turn out that the ordination of men only is normative. Okay? It's the norm. It's absolute. It's doctrinal. And that God on earth can be represented only by the male of the species and not by the female. And the theologians have discussed this, and they've come up with an answer. And the answer is, it's not historical and sociological, it's normative. Well, if you think about it, that means that the Christian God can only be represented on earth by the male of the species. Now, why is that the case? Why is God so essentially male? Bernardine didn't answer that question. I can't answer it. It's something to think about. I think most of us don't think probably that the ordination of men only it would be normative. We probably think it's a product of custom and habit and the patriarchal social tradition and so on. But there is a view that it is theological and normative and doctrinal. That means that God is essentially male and can only be represented by the male of the species on earth to others. Jung, of course, felt that that was a great deficit because it does leave out one half of the human species, after all. There may be an enormous difference, and as one Swiss psychologist told me, he was of the opinion that men and women were descended from different species altogether, and they met on a beach somewhere one time. So maybe the Christian God is representative of one line and not the other, But Jung wanted to bring these two sides together, right, the male and the female of the species, and so that the concept of God, he felt, needed to be feminized within Christianity. It needed to be, the feminine needed to be included imagistically as well as doctrinally somehow. And there's a story that in 1952 when Pope Pius announced that the doctrine of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, her physical elevation into heaven, was dogma. That Jung said to Dr. von Franz on that occasion, now you have a representative in heaven too. Because it's very interesting to think that a human body in the female form was taken up into the heavenly chambers. And as someone said in a seminar the other day, when Jesus was taken up, it was a transformed body and there was no plumbing that went along. But when the Virgin Mary was taken up, it was plumbing and all. So Jung felt that the inclusion of the feminine was more needed, this imagistic representation within the Godhead, that it needed to be, the feminine form needed to be included, but also the feminine principle, which is somewhat different and much broader. And by the feminine principle, he generally meant the material world, the body, that the body gets included in the spiritual somehow, and that there is a new uniting of spirit and body. And if you drive that all the way through to all its theological and metaphysical implications, which hasn't really been done yet, I think you'd come up with a very interesting theology. It would be one in which theology and science would be much closer wed, so that one would perceive the divine, theos, God, at work within the physical universe, within physics, within biology. God would be at work in genetics, so on, and in the plant and mineral world. The closest Jung gets to actually theologizing is in a chapter in his book, Ion, on the self, in which he draws elaborate diagrams and his most opaque writing anywhere in the collected works occurs in these sections, because he was so hesitant to broach genuinely theological territory. But the implications of what he says is that from the very highest levels of reality, the spiritual levels, all the way down through the psychological and the emotional and the physical and biological and the mineral, and right down to the carbon atoms, to the bottom that he calls the lapis, the stone, which bend back around each other and touch at the backside, this whole continuum of reality would be included within the doctrine of God. That God would not be seen as just up there or out there or a spiritual reality, but he would also be within the physical world. So you get something like a process theology. That would be the closest representation of the theologies that are available to what Jung would have in mind. And that's what he meant by including the feminine as well, actually, though, and I don't want to underemphasize this, as a female image within the doctrine of God. I think he felt that would be very important, too, the feminization of God. So these two points, that evil needs to be included, okay, and by that he means the shadow side of reality, like entropy, so on, and also the feminine need to be included right within the heart of the doctrine of God. And his discussion of that and his image for it is a quaternity. So we, instead of having a trinity, we'd have a quaternity, that is a foursome, four elements or four aspects, four figures, something like that, within the central vision of religious reality. I just want to take about 2 minutes to wind up and talk and just say a few things about Jung's vision for Christianity, the future of Christianity. And maybe we can discuss this during the question and answer period. What would that be if you take Jung's critique of Christianity and the assumption that he had the welfare of Christianity really at heart? What would it look like if Jung had his way and the patient progressed along the lines of individuation that he would have in mind for the patient? Well, one thing would be this idea of a quaternity. God is a quaternity, and all the implications that I just very briefly touched upon. But that would be the central perception of reality of this this new era of Christian thought. Another aspect of it would be that there would be a much stronger emphasis on personal experience rather than on belief of doctrines, belief of appropriation of externally imposed and validated religious doctrines. There's a wonderful short vignette in a little book by E.A. Bennett called Conversations with Jung, in which Bennett reports a conversation that he had with Jung one day in his old age. And Jung was telling him about a theologian who came to him for treatment. And the theologian from the University of Zurich said that the reason he was coming into analysis was that a student of his had raised such an issue in his own personal life that he really felt he needed to struggle with this in therapy and therefore was willing to engage in this arduous process with Jung. And the situation was that he had given a lecture at the university on the subject of theology and the reality of God and so on to a class of undergraduates. And after the class, a freshman, a young peasant lad from the countryside, came up to him and asked this sophisticated theologian a very simple, blunt question. How do you know that God exists? And the theologian was nonplussed. He'd been lecturing for an hour. He'd been studying the history of theology and the history of Christianity for a dozen years, probably. And he was stopped dead in his tracks by that question, that blunt question. How do you know that God exists? And Jung laughed, according to Bennett, and said, now that's the kind of student I would like to have. Okay? Ask that kind of simple-minded question. And the reason that Jung would like to have that kind of student was that that man would be capable of becoming the kind of theologian that Jung would want, the kind of theologian that would begin his writings by saying, this is what I've experienced, would start out by writing down his dreams, let's say, his visions, his inner experiences of God, and going on from there, so that theology would become a reflection upon a logos of the theos that we experience in our everyday life. That's why I'm interested in the religion of everyday life. I think that's the way a Jungian-oriented Christianity or religion would go, that every person would have access to revelation, that one's own scriptural text would unfold from one's inner experiences, visions, dreams, and so on. And not that that would be discontinuous necessarily with the religious tradition that's gone before, with what other people are experiencing, but it would have the quality of individual experience. It would be unique. Your dream images would be the basis of your theology and your understanding. And I think that emphasis on the individual and the scriptural text as unfolding from within would be an important feature of transformed Christianity as Jung would want to have it. And then finally, I think as a religious tradition, an awareness would come of Christianity's shadow. There would be a retrieval of projections, in Jung's view. And one of the problems of every religious tradition, and Christianity is absolutely no exception in this regard, is that it establishes an us-them split. And the us are the ones who know and have the truth, and the them are the ones who are benighted and pagans and need the truth. And as a result of that, Christianity hasn't really experienced its own shadow. And by shadow here, I mean its limitations and its the implications of its doctrine in the suffering of the human race. And I would put the blame for anti-Semitism, for example, squarely at the doorstep of Christianity. Not that Christianity created anti-Semitism and the Holocaust all of its own. It certainly didn't. Its priests didn't run the gas chambers. But it is deeply implicated in that human crime. And I think Christianity needs to realize and carry that shadow and that burden. That's not the only burden it needs to carry, but I think it needs to take fully into itself the realization of its shadow aspects in the history of Western culture. And once it would do that, I think it would have a real chance of individuating further. Once you realize your limitations, and you know you don't know it all, you're open for new revelation and new insight. So I think I'll stop there. We'll have our brief pause and then come back for some discussion. Thank you very much. Comments or a question to start off things? Yes. Yes. I think it's a very good question. This young woman says that she feels that most people prefer comfort to truth. And I would certainly agree with that. And that habits of thought and practice are so established that it's very difficult to imagine the tradition making any moves in the direction suggested by Jung to include the dark side of God in its theology or the feminization of the image of God. So what would Jung say are the chances of this happening, or how will it happen, and so on? I think it's a little presumptuous to speak for Jung, but I'll try to do that. And this is really my fantasy and my thought as well, but I'll put it into the words of Jung. I think Jung would say that probably the least likely of success would be for theologians to get busy and try to figure out a new doctrine of God and put that forward. That it would be an arbitrary symbol. And as one Jewish historian said after the collapse of the Weimar Republic in Germany, that period between the wars, he said, history loves to destroy arbitrary symbols. They just don't work. The ego can't do it. Okay, we can't just sit down and get busy and say we want to change the religious tradition and its doctrines and so on. And I don't think Jung would have thought it would come about that way, by people intentionally setting out to change it. But I think he would have said that it will change, because it's got to change. It will either die or change, as individuals do. There's a moment in therapy or in life when you take one path or another. You either decide you're going to die and call it quits, and you begin preparing yourself for that, and you slowly wither away and die, or you take another turn and live the rest of your life fully. And that's a decision that comes upon you. In a way, the ego makes it, in a way it doesn't. It participates in it, at least, let's say. Okay, that turning point is where Jung felt Christianity was, now toward the end of this month, of this Platonic year, 2,000 years, this second millennium of Christian history. And he felt that what it would involve would be the conscious participation, let's say, in a process that's going on in the collective unconscious. That the process of change is underway. And that process will be represented symbolically in various ways in history and culture, in people's personal experiences. And in such personal experiences as dreams of the goddess, let's say, okay, people will start dreaming about it and talking about it, thinking about it. It will sort of arise spontaneously. Or you can read the signs of the transcendent in history, as I suggested, the dark side of God in history, in warfare and destruction, persecution, holocausts, and all of that. And so in a way, a new perception of reality of God. For Jung, God equals reality. Those two concepts are about interchangeable. Talk about God, you're talking about reality. Our perception of reality, as it fundamentally is, ultimate reality, will change. And the religious tradition will either come along with that change or it'll wither away and maybe establish itself as a kind of minority sideline of history or something like that. Jung felt a guarded optimism, I think, that the religious tradition would change, that Christianity would change. But I'd say it would be a guarded optimism for his patient. One sign of that change might be underway was this enunciation of the doctrine of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, the dogmatization of that view, because Jung said he thought that was the most important religious event since the Reformation. So he placed a lot of weight on that as a symbol that the religious imagination was shifting. And once the feminine is up there in the heavenly chamber, at least close to the inner sanctum, if not a goddess, at least the feminine is right in there, doing something, incubating. There's now a womb present for something to incubate. Jung felt that there would be a new revelation incubating in the collective unconscious, and that would gradually be making itself known over the next centuries. There's a report of somebody who brought a dream to Jung, a man named Max Zeller. It's quite a well-known story. And Max Zeller was an analyst, a German, who fled to this country and lived in Los Angeles. Toward the end of his life, had a dream in which he was digging in the ground and building a sort of religious monument or religious tower, and he looked around and he saw other people doing this, and he says, as far as the eye could see, there were other people engaged in the same activity, digging down into the ground and building these monuments, and that all had a religious meaning to it. As far as the eye could see, so people, Chinese were doing it, and Indians were doing it, and all the races of the human species. And he told this dream to Jung, and Jung recognized it immediately as a perception of reality. And he said, oh yes, they're doing it in India, they're doing it in China. I know that, and I know from my patients and their dreams and my own intuitions that the new religion is being born. It'll take about 600 years. So he even put a time on it. 600 years and it will be in place, and apparently it'll be a new religion that will be worldwide. It will be non-tribal. It'll be a non-tribal religion. Human beings can no longer afford tribalism. We can't afford to think of God as our father, only our father. He's the father of lots of families. He's a promiscuous father. He's a father who's fathered this tribe and that tribe and the other tribe. And he's as gracious and hostile to them as he is to us. So God isn't the father of one group. There is no chosen people. They're all chosen people. It's that kind of sense of God and religion. And tribalism has got to go. Exclusivism has got to go. There's a story at the University of Chicago that Paul Tillich said at the end of his life, if he were starting his career, he would read two people to begin, Jung and Eliade. And the reason, I think, he didn't spell it out why he felt these two were important, but my feeling is that the reason he would start there is that the next bit of theologizing has to be on a completely non-tribal basis. It has to be on an archetypal, generally human basis, okay? And Eliade has been the history of religions. He's made religions conscious to us. We can no longer say there's one way, there's one truth, there's one doctrine. Can't say it. They're all truths. They're all good doctrines. They're all different ways to the same thing. And so this opening into non-tribal religion, I think, is a Jung felt would happen if we can hold out long enough and not let the dark side of God, so to speak, destroy the human race before it happens. If we can integrate it, become conscious of it, and take these necessary steps, then I think he felt fairly optimistic that Christianity could evolve, make its contribution to human religious thought and practice in the future. Yes.
Where did Jung get his definition of what Christianity is? I'm wondering, did he know Hebrew and Greek and read the scriptures, or did he take personal experiences from his father and relatives? You know,
yes.
How he evolved it, what he defined.
Both. He was quite conversant with all the texts. I mean, he was quite a scholar. If you read his works, there are lots of references to Greek and Latin. And in fact, he read Latin the way we can read English. He was. I don't know if he read Hebrew directly, but he did. He did have relationships with scholars of Hebrew and Old Testament scholars. And so he was a pretty careful scholar. And his view of Christianity was broad-based. It was not restricted to his own denomination at all. So he was a tremendous scholar and student of the history of not only Christianity, many religions. But it was really in the last 25 years of his life that he turned his attention to Christianity per se. And he did that because he had a dream. And he felt that on the basis of the dream, it was that his task in the last years of his life to try to help Christianity to heal itself. The dream occurred to him when he was in India, actually, and he said it changed his orientation altogether because it turned his attention, this was in 1938, to the problems of Western culture and Christianity in particular. It was a Holy Grail dream. Remember that one? He's standing in a castle, and with some other people, and they're waiting for the procession of the Grail. And then it turns out that they can't find the Grail. They have to go in search of the Grail so the Grail procession can take place. And the dream ends with Jung stripped bare and ready to plunge into the waters. He has to swim across this channel to the other side of the island to fetch the grail and bring it back so that the procession of the grail can complete itself. And he felt that that symbol, the grail symbol, was what Christianity needed. And if he could find that and provide it, it's the feminine, it's a container, and it's an important religious symbol, then he would have fulfilled the task of the last part of his life. And I think it was that dream and other factors that motivated him to put the main part of his energy into the study and the therapy, as I feel it was in the last 25 years of his life. Yes, back here.
I think that the metaphor that you described, you know, to like the
yes. Well, that view has been put forward by other people that Jung was grandiose in his tackling of these tremendous subjects, culture and religion, so on and so forth, and what right did he have to set himself up as the doctor of God, so to speak, right? This was actually the point of view of Victor White, and he wrote a review of Jung's answer to Job, and he said, well, now Jung has finally done it, he's finally gone past all bounds of reasonableness and sanity, and he has set himself up as a psychiatrist of God. And so there, I think there is room for that critique, my own feeling is that even if that is true, Jung did raise issues and questions that are vitally important for Christianity and Christian theologians to look at. I think one of the values of therapy, if you will, is to lend dignity and meaning to the struggles of individuals that otherwise can be written off as nothing but neurotic problems. I think most of us, if we would have difficulty with religious doctrines in Christianity, certainly would have been my experience, would think to ourselves, well, we've got a problem. There's something wrong with us. We don't quite understand it. We don't quite get it. We have to change ourselves a little bit. And that's certainly the line that Christian theologians and so on, will usually put forward. God always comes off the good guy and we come off the bad guys. God is complete and we're incomplete. God's the grandiose one, we're not, right? And in therapy we learn that our suffering matters, that our struggling does have a vital importance, and so the struggles and the individuation struggles, let's say, of the individual are given a dignity that and a sense of centrality and importance that isn't often granted. They are not written off as incidental or unimportant misperceptions of our subjectivity, and we need to adjust ourselves a little better. And although there is that side of it too, of course. So I think, in a way, Jung taking on God, while it may be the God of tradition, the God image of tradition, while it may sound grandiose, I think does give a sense of weight and dignity and importance to the human ego, to the human struggle with these enormous issues and difficulties. Now, I think all of this can be talked about in more theoretical terms, that the struggles of the individual often are a reflection of goings-on within a much wider area, much wider territory of reality than just the individual. I think every therapist has this experience that individuals will come into therapy feeling that their problems are unique and idiosyncratic and one of a kind, and nobody else has these problems, and will realize that one after another people will describe very similar situations, very similar struggles, and that these do indeed have a cultural import. Okay, that the struggle of the individual is often also reflected in collective and cultural issues that are being raised. The most obvious of these in our time is the struggle of the feminine, of women for self-esteem and self-value. Over and over in every therapist practice, women come in who are struggling with that issue. What is my value? What is my contribution? What is the value of the feminine, of my typology, of my ways that don't fit in with corporate thinking, aren't legal? You know, my husband thinks I'm crazy, and so on. And those idiosyncratic-seeming struggles are not. Those are cultural issues. They reach far beyond what that individual is struggling with. So it's the individual and the collective cultural struggles and conflicts are often very closely linked and closely related. So if there is some individual who is struggling with his or her religious tradition in a genuine way, they're also struggling with an issue in that tradition itself, an issue that has to be raised to consciousness and dealt with by the tradition. Just as the struggles of the individual with cultural biases and one-sidedness eventually have to be dealt with by the culture. And if enough individuals do it, of course, then it becomes a mass phenomenon. And then corporations have to deal with it, right? The structures of power have to deal with it. They have to give on it. They have to reinterpret themselves and reintegrate in a new way. So I think it's that kind of relation of the individual to the collective that I would make the argument for the value of Jung's struggles with Christianity. It wasn't just grandiose, that his struggles, his personal struggles with Christianity and his personal biography are representative. His life was a representative life in a way. It wasn't just for him. He wasn't just idiosyncratic. And I think that's why he speaks to so many people. When they come to Jung and read Jung, it is like a conversion experience. They say, here's a man who understands me. Here's a man who struggles with the kinds of thoughts that I've always been afraid to think, or I couldn't speak about, or I sort of half thought. And he brings them out, all the way out there, puts them out on the table. So that it's like a homecoming. They feel understood. Their soul is met. Here's a man who's struggled with soul issues that resonate with the half-conscious experience of many people. So in that sense, I think he speaks a language that's important far beyond his own idiosyncratic needs and issues. Yes?
It seems to me that Christianity, by definition, demands that you make a decision as to if it's true or false. That's all that matters. These Christianity interpretation marks, everything you know.
The emphasis on belief, belief in certain propositions.
It doesn't seem to me that you have any room to make for accepting some of the things that they have to do. I find myself kind of caught because I think what you're saying about the emphasis on personal experience of religion is really important. It's becoming more important for me than the idea of people building religious edifices. But there's also a communal aspect of religion. It's important for people to come together. And I just wonder, you know, I feel sort of caught because I'm not a person who's comfortable with New Age religion. Religions that are basically foreign to our tradition. But I'm also not ready to say that Christianity, you know, by definition, is true. But I want to go to church. You know, kind of. I just wonder what you think about that.
Community.
Dilemma.
Yeah. In the Jungian approach, there is such an emphasis on the individual and on inner experience and sort of the privacy of one's inner life and active imagination and dreams and all that individuation, becoming who you really are, so on and so forth, that the question does often come up, what about community? Is there any way that these individuating entities get together and have anything to say to each other, anything to share with each other? I can imagine a community, and a community of individuating entities, but I think it would be very different from the ways in which churches have traditionally structured themselves, because I think the locus of authority would always be held by the individual. It would never get beyond the individual. Okay, and that makes it very difficult for groups to function in any kind of collective way. You know, how do you cooperate about anything? How could you organize a ritual, a worship service, anything like that? And you probably couldn't. My thought about it is that it would be maybe something along the lines of a Quaker meeting. If you've ever been to a Quaker meeting, there isn't too much structure to it except that everybody agrees to be quiet and sit in a circle, and there's no designated leader, nobody preaches at you, there's no sort of collective activity or ritual, hymn singing or anything of that sort. And you wait for the spirit to strike somebody, and they'll stand up and say a few words, and you listen to it. Some meetings are completely quiet, silent, other meetings are quite active. People bring their concerns forward, can share their experiences if they want to. And there is no hierarchical structuring other than a political one. Somebody has to be the treasurer and bookkeeper and that sort of thing, but there isn't like a bishop or a body of doctrine that you have to believe in or subscribe to. Usually pacifism is a part of the shared value of the people who belong to the Quaker meetings. So I'm rather fond of that kind of idea. I don't think in a Jungian-oriented approach there could be collective doctrines, but I think after a while, if enough people would share their experiences and their dreams and what they felt the meaning of those dreams were, a kind of collective sense of values and themes would emerge, like it does in a dream series. Now, if you record your dreams over a number of years, you will recognize themes running through the dream series. Sometimes images repeat themselves, or themes are represented in variations on a theme. So the series thematizes itself, and I think probably something like that would happen in a group of individuating entities sharing their experiences. Certain themes would emerge as being shared in common. Jung was rather himself down on groups. He thought people in groups fell to the lowest common denominator. Generally speaking, groups did not raise consciousness. They moved to destroy consciousness, to collectivize people, to make them false to their deepest truths. And so he would be suspicious of what groups do to the individual. And the only group I know that Jung was really involved in or sponsored and was a part of, it was this thing called the Psychological Club in Zurich. And it was a group of people who gathered together and listened to talks like this one sometimes, or shared their experiences. But the impression I get from the thing is, as I've read about it, is that they also believed in honesty, right? They knew they were not related to each other through the persona, as we say. They knew that everybody had a shadow, and everybody was bad. Everybody was both good and bad, right? And they could accept that reality. They could be mean to each other and hostile if they felt that way on a given day. And so there was an allowance of shadow activity, a toleration for it. And so Jung himself dropped out of the club for 10 years at one point. So sort of come and go, and there wasn't a sense that you had to be committed to it. And yet it's continued to survive and still functions in Zurich and so on. So maybe that kind of a group experience. But I think there would be much more of an emphasis on the individual, and I think community would be a real problem. I don't know how to solve it. I've thought a little bit about it. The question always comes up. I'll just leave it with you to work on some more. Yes? With Emerson. Yeah. So, yes, right. I think you'd have difficulty with the Mormons. A paper has been written on Jung and Emerson by Edward Edinger. It was published a number of years ago. And I think there are similarities. I think there are also differences. I don't think Emerson had... I know he didn't have anything like a view of human nature that Jung has, and the unconscious and the shadow, and sort of what Jung would call the shadow element or the earth.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.